I need your advice. It's something I want to do, something I have to do. But it'll divide the Night's Watch. Bitterly. Half the men will hate me the moment I give the order.
Half the men hate you already, Lord Commander. Do it.
But you don't know what it is.
That doesn't matter. You do. You will find little joy in your command. But with luck, you will find the strength to do what needs to be done. Kill the boy, Jon Snow. Winter is almost upon us. Kill the boy. And let the man be born. Kill the boy. Kill the boy. Kill the boy. Kill the boy. Jon Snow.
Game of Thrones. Oh my God.
There's dragons.
Gotta watch it. You see them. There's this fight scene. There's this fire. And so they're really small.
Winter is coming.
I'm helpless. The guy that the season's going on. I'll see you get bigger.
Watch your
head. Now they're amazing.
What does Jakari's mean?
He lost his hair. Fucking red wedding.
I cannot give you back your homes or restore your dead to life, but perhaps I can give you justice in the name of Arkhan.
Jakari's.
Welcome back to the Coffee Klatch Crew Game of Thrones episode review. I'm Jason Pistorino.
I'm Christina Lomangino.
And today we are reviewing episode 5, Kill the Boy.
Yeah. Title which had a lot of people speculating, I think, on metaphorical meanings or real meanings, but we finally find out what's behind Kill the Boy. Before we get into the episode, I just wanted to share with you a clip from an HBO interview they did with the actor who plays Theon. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce his name, Ewan. Anyhow, they asked him, how much does Ramsay relish parading Reek before Sansa for an apology? This was a scene that had us all, I think, a little bit on edge, a little tense. He answers, Ramsay is always up for a little performance. It's also a bit of a power thing. He didn't necessarily want Reek to meet Sansa until he was ready. That they've inadvertently met means that he feels the need to regain the power. So dinner was a wonderful opportunity to make them both feel terrible. It's just a game to Ramsay. When he gets bored, people get hurt. I think this guy is doing an amazing job of acting Ramsay's character, and this just goes to show, for me, he really understands the inside of Ramsay's psyche.
Yeah, definitely. And he's doing really well because I legitimately hate Ramsay.
A few notes about this episode. It's only the 4th episode in the entire TV series in which King's Landing does not appear at all, which I think had some people a little upset.
Well, that's right. I didn't even realize that because we have new locations that we'll get into later, but I didn't miss it. Whatever.
I didn't either. They spent the great majority of the time in the north, which I thought was wonderful. The same guy is going to write the next episode as this one.
Okay.
So I think he did sort of what they do in the books, that he's planning on splitting up the locations and the characters into 2 episodes, and I felt that allowed us to delve deeper into the character development, what's going on in these plots. I don't know, to me it just made a lot more sense, and I certainly still felt the progression. It didn't feel like anything was crawling or we were waiting for things to move.
In a way, they do that often anyways, or every episode at least. They split it up into sections. There's so many different locales. But I guess, and I never noticed, that there's always at least one scene with King's Landing in it, or almost always.
Yeah, and they usually move faster through the bullet points. A short scene at King's Landing, a short scene at Meereen. This one, they got to spend a little more substantial time in each place.
Jon Snow mentions prominently in his dialogue with Tormund that, according to legend at least, the wall was built 8,000 years ago.
Yeah, I noticed that they made a point to say that several times, and I don't think before now we actually knew how old the wall was.
Yeah, and does that mean that winter has been gone for that long?
I don't think so.
They build
I think
it during the winter.
Yeah, I think that's when they started to realize that they needed something to protect them against the things that lived beyond the wall when the Andals came over to Westeros and started taking over. They didn't have any magic. They didn't have anything else to sort of guard them against that. So I have a feeling that that might have been when it started.
I got a feeling. But how did they build a wall that big? They didn't have the technology we have. Do you think they did the same thing the Egyptians did, which was like aliens built it for them?
I don't think so. And I do think they talk a little bit about that in the book, A History of Westeros. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to have to go back and read a little bit into that. But if you're interested, I think that might be the place to find it. Also in that same speech, Jon Snow is speaking. Now that he's been elected Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, he's technically ruler not only of the Wall, but this area called the Gift. So for those of you who don't know exactly what the Gift is...
The Gift is the lands immediately south of the Wall, meant to support the Night's Watch. It is a strip of territory north of Winterfell and Last Hearth.
Yeah, it's an area where they're able to sort of grow their harvest for the Wall, more of a bountiful region, although it's pretty much been abandoned for a while now.
That's the area that they last season kind of demolished, right? Or part of it?
That's where we saw, yeah, briefly a little clip of it when the Thens were coming, and I think that's where Jon's speaking of settling the wildlings in to give them land south of the Wall. So Ramsay mentions the upcoming wedding being praised from Moat Cailin to the Last Hearth. As seen last episode, Moat Cailin is the southernmost point in the north, serving as the only gateway through the otherwise impassable swamps of the Neck. That's the castle that Roose ordered Theon to sort of take for them, that really boggy area that we got a view of when Brienne was making her trek into the north.
Okay.
So that's Moat Cailin.
Last Hearth, meanwhile, in the northernmost castle seat in the north, and therefore in all the Seven Kingdoms, Last Hearth is the seat of House Umber, staunch allies of the Starks.
So this is really far north, and this is the seat of House Umber, where I think we kind of were led to believe maybe that's where Asha and Rickon were going when Bran and them all split up and he wanted them to go somewhere safe to stay with one of their allies. House Umber always used to be one of the greatest supporters of the Starks, although I'm not completely sure on that. And our last note here, this episode marks the first appearance of Bowen Marsh. The first he has with speaking lines anyways. Some of you are probably wondering who that is and why he's important. He's the first steward of the Night's Watch. These titles were a little more important in the books, Jason. They kind of got into the ranking order. So he was first steward. A man named Othel Yarwick is the first builder. And now we've seen Sir Alistair was appointed as the first new ranger. They're kind of like the captains of each team. You know, okay. The stewards do this, the builders build castles, the rangers go north of the wall on expeditions. So all three are present in the meeting scene in this episode, and they make up the commanding officers, you know, underneath the Lord Commander, Jon Snow. So there's a lot to talk about in this episode. I think this might have been my favorite episode of Game of Thrones to date. There was not one moment that I was bored. I was just incredibly blown away by the interactions with the characters, places that I never imagined we'd see on TV before. Can't wait to talk about that. Although I guess we'll start in maybe my least favorite place of the episode, which was Meereen.
Missandei visits a bedridden Grey Worm and delivers news of Ser Barristan Selmy's death. The unsullied warrior is ashamed, not of his defeat, but because he was afraid he would never see Missandei again. She climbs into his bed and kisses him.
Yeah, this is sort of a whatever to me. I mean, I kind of think that they added the storyline of these two because there's just not enough love stories in Game of Thrones as a counterpoint to all the death and war that's going on. They felt the need to make one up, I guess.
Well, they needed to let us know that Grey Worm was alive.
Oh, for sure. I just mean their whole romance in general.
Okay.
In the books, Missandei's only 10 years old. She was aged up like a lot of other characters were, so I guess it, you know, it was okay, fitting to give her a love story here. Her importance in the books is that she's actually really intelligent, and she becomes a key advisor to Dany, to the point that in the books, Dany lets her sit as an advisor on her ruling council. The next scene, as Ser Barristan's lying there, Dany commands that the leaders of the great Meereenese families are to be brought before her. But before we get into that, what did you think about the way they handled Barristan's death? I mean, I feel like he got no play at all. He got no, it was like sort of, okay, it's really sad that he crossed the half a world to serve me, but he's dead.
I guess the nod to him was before he died. His last speech with her, that was the way they gave him a nod.
Right. Okay, so the story he was telling her about her brother.
Yeah, and there's so many deaths in Game of Thrones that if they felt the need to kind of dwell on each death, we'd probably get bored real quick.
Yeah, I just thought he was such an important character that maybe you might get a little bit more. But again, just remember that he was not dead in the books, so I don't know what this means, if this is a foreshadowing that he will die in the books. He did have some more important things left to do. Perhaps they'll give that to another character, maybe Jorah. Anyway, Dany leads the group of former masters into the catacombs, where her other two dragons are chained. And on her order, one of the masters is fed to the creatures in spectacular form.
That was awesome. We got to see the dragons again, and this time it wasn't just for a half a second clip. We got to see the dragons a lot, all three of them, actually. But yeah. This one, you know, they start off in the dark, and you see the nose first, and then the eyes open, then fire. That would look cool in 3D. And then the way they Mortal Kombat, like,
finish him,
where the two dragons rip that guy apart, and there's blood everywhere. I thought that was cool.
Fatality.
Very expensive, but awesome. And I think this is kind of like a way of them showing this is how Cersei is going to get back on her dragon's good side, or kind of bond with them again. She's bringing them trophies, at the same time reminding her city men or her people, you know, don't forget I'm the Queen of Dragons.
Yeah, for sure. It was a good intimidation tactic for these masters who feel like they've been able to get away with anything. And I think, you know, not recognizing Ser Barristan's death, this was sort of the way that we did that. To show that Dany was upset about it. She wasn't going to forget about it, and she was going to get her vengeance. The only thing I didn't like, did you notice her face when the dragons were torching the man? I mean, she had that glitter in her eyes, like she was
getting wet. Ow.
Like she was fixated on it. Like it was amazing. It just, to me, screamed Targaryen. Like mad Targaryens. I can't getting off of watching my dragon burn people. And it was a little bit, perhaps not such a political move in that moment, but what she wanted to do deep down, and it scared me a little. Made me think, could Dany not turn eventually into a bad guy and not necessarily a good guy? Could she cross that line someday?
Well, of course she's going to have some of the bad Targaryen in her, but I read it a different way. I read it as she's looking at her children and kind of bonding again, for the first time in a while. Mm. And it wasn't about the body or the fire. It was more about being with her children and seeing them again in action. I think it was more of that qualified her face.
Yeah. I guess it's tough for me to get away from, I thought the decision she made in the book maybe was a little better. She took hostages, children from each of the noble families, to serve her as cupbearers. She didn't hurt them. She didn't do anything to them. But the families knew that she had someone from each one, should they do something wrong. She also demanded blood money from each family for her followers or soldiers that were killed from the Sons of the Harpies. They had to pay for it. She never threw his daughter in jail. She never burned anybody with the dragons. She tried to really make the smart political move here. Although I guess that wouldn't have played as well on TV. We wanted the action.
I think she had to show her strong hand. I mean, they just killed her men and killed her second-hand man. So, or first-hand man.
Yeah, and I agree with that decision. I also agree with her reopening the fighting pits. I think that's going to go a long way to appeasing some of her people. However, her last decision, you know, Missandei advised her that she needed to trust her own decisions and, you know, weigh the counsel of the people supporting her, but also sometimes ignore it. she goes down to visit his darnest cell where he begs for his life. And she tells him she was wrong. And in order to solidify the bond with the people, she will marry the great head of the family.
Yeah, that was a twist I did not see coming.
I don't know that I think that's the way to reconcile the political unrest that's going on in her kingdom. And also, it raises a lot of questions for the future. If she goes back and takes Westeros, is she then going to be unable to marry somebody that she really needs to form a political alliance there? Will she do like former Targaryens have done and take multiple husbands?
Probably.
Will Hisdar wind up meeting an unfortunate accident if she needs to get him out of the way? I mean, you know, what's going to happen there?
I don't think she's even thinking about King's Landing at this point.
Yeah, and that's what frightens me. You know, that was supposed to be the ultimate goal, and yet it seems like she's willing to do whatever she needs to in order to make peace in this territory. I don't know. It's seeming like this is the ultimate goal for her.
She'd probably be the safest from White Walkers at that point because she's separated by sea with them.
Yes, that is true.
Not that she's thinking that way, but...
I don't even think she knows White Walkers exist at this point or that there is that danger. I'm wondering why nobody from Westeros has sent that letter. I mean, we see later at the Wall that Aemon's receiving news about her.
Oh, that's right.
And what's going on with her out there. So why is nobody, you know, sending her a little raven? A message. Hey, bitch, get over here with your dragons. We need some help at the Wall.
Well, that message was that we need help. And maybe they did say winter's coming. Last episode, Jon Snow had to put his John Hancock on all these messages.
Oh, yeah, but there wasn't one to Danny, I don't think. I think they would have mentioned that. But that, yeah, that's there should be one going over to her there. Well, speaking of the Wall, let's move on and talk about what's happened there.
Sam reads the news of the rebellion in Slaver's Bay to Maester Aemon, who laments, "A Targaryen alone in the world is a terrible thing." Jon Snow privately consults Aemon about a decision he knows will divide the Watch. The wise man encourages the new Lord Commander to be courageous in his leadership. Aemon tells Jon, "And let the man be born."
Great quote. Really smart advice, I thought, from Maester Aemon. It was a complicated bunch of short little clips going on there. I mean, you're really seeing that, first of all, Maester Aemon is convinced that he's dying soon. He's 100 years old. I think he really wants to be able, he wishes he was able, to go to Dany and sort of guide her, protect her. He's lamenting that he can't do that and wondering what's going to happen to her. I thought it was interesting, for those of you out there, conspiracy theorists, who think that Jon Snow could be part Targaryen, that in fact there are two Targaryens, maybe possibly here at the Wall together, and they just don't know that. That would be a fun twist.
Mm.
But if we remember, this was something Aemon had to struggle with his entire life. He explained to Jon back in season one, and again in season four, that he was actually born Prince Aemon Targaryen, but gave up his family name when he became a maester and later joined the Night's Watch. He explained to Jon that he had a long-forgotten uncle, the mad King Aerys II. He became a maester because he wasn't the eldest son and heir, but after his older brother died, there were some who offered the crown to him. But he refused, told them about his vows and that he couldn't enter into that now that he was part of the Night's Watch. I think it was a decision he really struggled with, so...
Oh, yeah.
This is another catching point for him. You know, he made peace with that for a long time. But now, when it seemed as though the Targaryens would be gone for a while, potentially there is somebody else coming back, another Dragon Lord to rule. And it's making that decision hard for him again, I believe.
Some would say he was blinded with ambition. Jon approaches Tormund with a proposition. He will rescue the wildlings north of the Wall and allow them to settle on southern lands in exchange for their aid with fighting the White Walkers. "Make peace to save your people," Jon urges as he unchains him. Tormund agrees to evacuate
Hardhome, the village where wildlings took refuge, but the Lord Commander himself would have to go and present the idea to them.
Yeah, I mean, I like what he said. I like what Jon Snow admitted to Tormund here, that for 8,000 years, they have essentially failed in their duty to, quote-unquote, guard the realms of men, because the wildlings are part of that. And he knows they're going to be more screwed if all of these people wound up being converted to White Walkers. And I don't understand in the upcoming scenes where none of the Night's Watch, none of the brothers seem to understand that this is a much more imminent threat to them. They have to put these years of quibbling behind them. And Tormund does seem to really get that. He is maybe even more on board with this than Mance Rayder would have ever been. But he tells Jon he's got to come with him. And that really scares the shit out of me. I mean, you can already see that it's starting to snow in the background of some of these scenes. Now, they're talking about going way far north, where the weather's already going to be bad, to these wildlings that might just want to kill Jon or tell him to, you know, fuck off, that they don't want to go anywhere with him. I just don't see how this is going to end well. If we remember, it took Mance how many years and how much work to get these people together to fight for anything. And this is somebody they don't even know who's going to walk in and tell them, hey, come on south of the wall and everything will be cool.
Yeah, and they might just kill him and keep all the boats. But I think it's a ballsy move and interesting. I hope they don't, you know, stretch this for 4 seasons. I'd like to see this play out quick so we can move on and see what happens. I'd like to see some goddamn White Walkers. And there definitely needs to be more action this season. Not to be a party pooper here, but I need some more action.
See, I thought we got that in this episode. I feel like there has been a lot of buildup, but this episode we finally got a lot of stuff happening. I mean, we find out Jon's going to leave now. Stannis is leaving to march south. There's going to be a battle at Winterfell. Stuff is at least starting to occur. This is the upswing of action here,
yeah,
I think.
No, I know, and we're halfway through the season.
Yeah, kind of where we'd expect to be at episode 5. Well, the better compromise, I thought, in the book was that Jon sent Val, who was a wildling girl, a companion of Mance's wife, Dalla. Now, we never saw any of this, but when Mance's wife died, when they first got to the wall, when the battle was happening in childbirth, there was this other woman, Val, who was like the new wildling princess, as they kept calling her, because she was the next one under Dalla. And Jon sort of established a tenuous relationship with her. He had a little bit of trust for her. So he sent her north of the wall to find the wildlings left after battle. Although most of them were already there at the wall. It really was pretty much a small number of those left north. And the remaining wildlings were led by Tormund himself through the wall, because he wasn't captured in the battle. He wanted them to come south of the wall, not to settle it, but to occupy the empty castles along the wall, all the ones that we've been talking about that aren't being used, so that they could hold it for them when the White Walkers attacked.
Okay.
And to me, that makes a lot of sense. You have all these castles that could be used to defend, but nobody to man them. So put the wildlings in there, right?
I dig it, yeah, definitely.
So it goes a little differently here in the books. The men of the Night's Watch are not receptive to this proposal that Jon Snow puts before them. We can learn to live with the wildlings, or we can add them to the army of the dead, he says. I think a pretty convincing argument, but only Sam stands behind him. And even Sam has trouble talking people into it. He sort of gives up halfway through.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of understandable. They just had a war with giants and Their brethren were just killed.
Yeah, and we see Ollie is particularly upset, talking about how they killed his whole family. But don't they get it? Don't they get it that for as big as they think this ongoing strife is between them and the wildlings, that if they leave them north and they turn into White Walkers, they're not even going to hardly be able to defend whatever is north of the wall as is. If they add more walkers to that, how could they stand a chance? I mean, not one person in that room understands this concept.
Well, he should have kind of broke it down for them more. But I guess that would have been boring to watch. I would have broken it down.
Well, and I think he did. you know, we can add them to the Army of the Dead. Do you guys want that? And, you know, they still didn't really. So then we switch to Sam and Gilly, who are exploring the Night's Watch library. And he admits that before joining the Watch, he dreamt of becoming a maester. I thought that was kind of important. They didn't give it much credence here, but part of the reason that he has such a bad relationship they keep hinting at with his father was just a cruel man and never thought that Sam was really worth anything because he was fat, he was never going to be a fighter. But in fact, we know he's very intelligent, and when he explained to his dad that he wanted to be a maester, Randall Tarly said, "The Tarly men do not wear chains. They do not bow and scrape to petty lords." I mean, he really made him feel like to become a maester is to become a servant. What the hell is the matter with you? I want my son to be a warrior. So I think when Stannis comes in and is talking about how his father was one of the greatest warriors, I mean, the only battle Robert ever lost was to him. It's kind of salt in that wound for a minute. Until Stannis switches to sort of acknowledging what Sam is doing here and the fact that it's important, and you can see Sam light up again. You know, somebody wants to know about all these books I've been reading and why it's important to what we're doing here. So Stannis says, "I'm told you killed a White Walker." And Sam discloses that he used a dragonglass dagger, and this is when they sort of figure out this could be the weapon they need.
Yeah.
Stannis encourages him to keep reading, that they have to be ready when the Army of the Dead arrives. Now, I thought this part was a little bit funny. In the books, Stannis knows that Dragonstone, his home, has some dragonglass, but it's apparently useless, given that it's too sharp to be used in construction, but too brittle to be used in swords. But in the TV show here, in effect, he just withdrew this biggest stockpile of known anti-walker weapons, and he just sort of, you know, kind of nonchalantly saying, "Oh, hey, I think we got a lot of that on Dragonstone. You know, there might be a shit ton of obsidian there. This could be really good." In the books, Sam discovered by chance that dragonglass is one of the few materials that can harm or kill others. It is sharper than steel, but more brittle. That's why they turn it into daggers and not swords. According to legend, the Children of the Forest would provide the Night's Watch with a certain amount of dragonglass every year so that they could use it to fight others. Stabbing another with dragonglass will cause it to melt into a puddle of very cold liquid. Sam later stabs a white with a dragonglass dagger, but discovers that it has no effect on them. Not any more than a regular sword, anyhow. And there are also some notes claiming that dragon steel, which could be Valyrian steel, might also be lethal to the others, but we haven't found that out yet. I thought that would be a really cool twist, because there was only a couple of Valyrian steel swords in the kingdom right now.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the people that are wielding them will be really important to this battle that we're about to fight. Sort of another unknown weapon.
So dragon glass is different from Valyrian.
From dragon steel, correct. Dragon glass is what we know of as obsidian. That black material looks like black stone that they're making daggers out of.
Okay.
Valyrian steel are the special sword blades that we've seen. You know, Ned's sword Ice was made out of that. But famously, we saw Tywin melting down Ned's sword to make two, and that was Valyrian steel.
That's so the kind that can kill walkers.
Well, they're saying that might be able to. The obsidian for sure does. The dragonglass for sure does. But Valyrian steel might also. That's just a theory that they haven't tested yet. But we're also learning here that, yeah, it kills others, but it doesn't do anything on the whites. So I'd like to just take a brief sidebar here for a second. I've had some people asking, they don't really understand, they don't really remember, what is the difference between White Walkers and Whites? So we're going to just briefly go through this. The White Walkers are a mythological race that they mention. 8,000 years before Robert's Rebellion, a winter known as the Long Night lasted a generation. In the darkness and cold of the Long Night, the White Walkers descended upon Westeros from the farthest north, the lands of always winter. None knew why they came, but they killed all in their path, reanimating the dead as whites to kill the living at their command. Eventually, the people of Westeros rallied, and in a conflict known as the War for the Dawn, they managed to defeat the White Walkers and drive them back into the uttermost north, with the wall raised to bar their return. There you go, Jason, that's why the wall was built. In the present day, most believe they never existed, and they're just myths. They have not been seen for thousands of years, so people don't really think it's so much of a concern anymore. But we've seen on the show the White Walkers are taller. They have long, wispy white hair, pale gray-white skin, and these really sort of glowing blue eyes. They also seem to have sort of a ruling class or a priestly class that we saw gathering around to transform that baby.
Right.
So, you know, maybe they're in charge. They possess magical powers somehow related to the ice and the cold. Normally, when they come, blizzards come, it gets a lot colder. They have superhuman strength. And they also have the ability to reanimate the dead as their servants. And they're known as Wights. So these sort of skeleton figures that we saw rise out of the ground to kill Jojen, those are just regular Wights. They're just dead corpses. They're basically doing the bidding of these magical White Walkers. Okay. That's why we're afraid to have too many dead bodies killed north of the wall, because essentially that's becoming the White Walkers' personal army of the undead, if you will. So White Walkers equal magical beings, Wights equal reanimated dead corpses.
Thriller with Michael Jackson.
Yeah, pretty much. So hopefully that clears it up for you guys.
Stannis tells Davos that it's time to march for Winterfell, including Queen Selyse and Princess Shireen. The next morning, Jon bids farewell to Stannis and the army marches south.
So officially, there they go. And a little bit of a surprise to me that he's taking the queen and the princess with him. I mean, you think that's smart, taking them into battle?
I thought we knew that, though, because last episode he spoke and he said, of course, you're coming with me.
Yeah, I just thought Davos might be able to convince him that this is not a good idea, that they'd be safer, perhaps, at the wall. But and in the books, they do, in fact, stay back. Even Melisandre stays back with a small contingent of Stannis' men. And Davos did not march with Stannis because he was sent to negotiate with another lord, Lord Manderly, at White Harbor, hoping to get another ally for Stannis. So Stannis was, in fact, alone with his army when he marched on Winterfell in the books.
I would, if I was going to war, I'd bring the woman that has the magic vagina with me, too.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense from his point of view here.
Moving on to Winterfell, Brienne looks at Winterfell from afar, watching for Sansa, identifying herself as a Stark loyalist. Brienne recruits an old man to help her deliver a message. Later at Winterfell, the old servant woman returns to Lady Stark. Should Sansa ever need help, the woman explains, she should light a candle in Winterfell's broken tower, the highest window.
Yeah, like that's going to be such an easy place to get to if she's in trouble, huh? The highest window in the tallest tower. But I thought that this was kind of a cool throwback to, this is the tower that Bran got pushed out of.
Yep.
And the one that he used to climb where he gets visions of the three-eyed raven. A symbolism that's kind of tying back the Starks being in Winterfell again.
I think it's cool because Brienne's going to be out there with the regular folk, and she's going to be kind of Sansa's spy without Sansa even knowing, really. But she'll have her ear to the ground. And she'll probably find out about Miranda and her fucked upness.
Yeah, I was wondering, though, it seems as though she is somewhere in the Winterfell castle, Brienne. So how's she going to get away with this? Sansa knows what she looks like. Other people probably know what she looks like. How's she going to hide out and be not found? I don't know. It's just a little bit of a weird plan for me. I guess we'll have to see how that unfolds. Probably the scene that scared me the most coming up. Miranda, who is Ramsay's lover, expresses concerns about his impending marriage to Sansa. So you have that whole scene between them where he tells her jealousy bores me, and they have their weird sexual power struggle scene going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have trouble figuring out if Miranda is sort of as equally psychotic as Ramsay and they're a perfect match, or was she at one point maybe a normal person who got really beaten down and abused like Theon was, and now she's doing whatever takes to save her own life? Or, what is Miranda? What is her role? Because it could make her more or less dangerous in the long run to Sansa. I think it appears here as though she's totally bonkers, because she then goes to Sansa to sort of introduce her to Theon.
I think it's only fair that we see Sansa naked because we can see Miranda naked.
Oh, she's got a nice body, that Miranda. She looks a little different clothed than unclothed.
I thought it was very nice.
So when Sansa was walking down the kennels, what did you think she was going to see?
I thought one of their wolves.
Yeah, a dire wolf, right?
Yeah. I was like, wolf watch, here we come.
I was so excited. And then I was like, oh, no, it's just Miranda being a psycho bitch. But what a great introduction. We were talking about what would Sansa do when she finally sees Theon.
Yeah, I know.
And
she froze for a second.
I think her acting could have used work on that scene, but Theon's response was amazing.
You shouldn't be here.
The shuddering, the slinking back against the wall. I mean, he's really been reduced to almost an animal living amongst these dogs in a kennel.
Yeah.
It was pretty amazing.
I thought it was a good scene, and it set up the rest very well.
Yeah. Yeah, later, Theon confesses the encounter to Ramsay, who commands his pet to get on his knees. And I thought there was going to be some finger flaying when he asked for his hand.
Oh, me too. I was like, oh, shit.
I was hiding my eyes behind my hands going, no, no more flaying. But he winds up just playing these games with him, as usual, telling him he forgives him. And then they move on to the weirdest family dinner ever.
Yeah, I think that was Ramsay trying to flex in front of his parents and in front of his new wife to be. But it backfired a little bit, and Roose had to let him know and remind him that he controls Ramsay's life.
Yeah, I think part of this was he didn't like that Miranda had blown his first surprise, sort of taken a little power away from him, introducing Theon to Sansa. So he was trying to get that back, parading Theon in front of her. He was, I think, liking the entire table, squirming with discomfort, making Theon apologize for murdering Bran and Rickon, and then talking about how Reek was going to give Sansa away at the wedding. I mean, it was just really
rude,
over the top, and he was doing it in his psycho Ramsay way. Really brilliant. But then, yeah, Roose takes the power back in one swift move, like, boom, Walda's pregnant.
Yeah, I said last time, I'll say it again, he reminds me of Tywin. He's smart, he's very strategic, he's very stout.
Yeah, he's always five steps ahead.
Yeah.
Ramsay thinks he's got plans going on, but Roose is, he's always thinking way ahead of him. He's not going to outmaneuver him.
Yeah, and I have to say, I forgot about Roose's wife.
She's Walda.
A fat cow.
Well, of course, you remember that story that she was one of the Frey women. Walder Frey had about 1 million women he was trying to get rid of, and some of them, I guess, on the larger size, maybe not so good looking as they're described in the book. So in order to kind of get them out, he proposed to Roose, whatever wife he chose, he would give their weight in dowry. So however big they were, that's how much gold he was going to give them. So Roose picked the biggest one he could find, according to the books. He's just he's a great man, that Roose.
He's a great man.
Well, Roose says that Walda's pregnant and most likely it's a boy. And this brought up a bunch of questions in our emails and responses. How does the legitimization of bastard children work in the kingdom? So can they give it away? Can they take it back? I did a little reading. It said it's granted rarely enough that there are no formal rules for how it impacts the line of succession. Mm-hmm. It's up to the discretion of the lord, and I guess civil wars resulted from disputes on that in the past. If a lord had a bastard son and later a lawful son by a married wife, the younger but lawful son is his legal heir. If the elder bastard were later legitimized, however, his own supporters would say he is now the heir because he's older, but others would argue that even an older legitimized bastard ranks behind a younger but lawful son. So it's caused a lot of problems, basically, in the Seven Kingdoms, and it seems that if Ramsay were to cause problems and Roose were to just say, hey, I don't think I want you to be my son anymore, that nobody would really contest that. Bottom line, he's got the power over Ramsay, and Ramsay knows it.
Got the power.
I mean, what's the line that he says to his father in the next scene?
I'm your son only while it's convenient, something like that.
Yeah, until a better alternative.
Right,
yeah. You know, like he knows he's waiting for a legal son to come along.
He's waiting.
And then he shares this story about how Ramsay came into the world. That Roose raped Ramsay's mother for marrying without his consent. You know, I mean, no wonder he started out in such a situation. I thought this was interesting, even worse than that. In the books, they don't mention this detail that the Boltons often practice something that's been banned, a banned practice called the first night, in which a lord has the right to have sex with a commoner's wife on their wedding night before the husband. The miller and his wife were married in secret without Roose's knowledge, and he was mad that he didn't get to exercise his right to the first night. So he came to find these people and to take that right back. And in the books, oddly, Ramsay actually seems to care about his mother. It's like the one person he does care about. Even to the point that he developed this warped fantasy interpretation of his origins, that Roose genuinely fell in love with his peasant mother, like it was something out of a fairy tale. Hmm. But either way, Roose said that when Ramsay was first presented to him as a baby, he wanted to throw him into the river, but he looked at him and realized, and specifically in the books, it was this distinctive Bolton eye color, these pale blue eyes, nearly white, with pupils that had specks like dirty ice.
Ooh.
So he knew from the second he looked at him, it was his. And interestingly enough, that echoed in season 3. Tywin Lannister had said after Tyrion's mother died in childbirth, on top of the humiliation that he was born a stunted dwarf, he considered throwing Tyrion into the ocean too. But he couldn't, because when he looked at him, into his eyes, he knew he was a Lannister. So just a lot of cool tie-ins going on here.
Let's move on to Valyria.
Yes, please.
Jorah and Tyrion sail for Meereen. Jorah navigates them through the ruins of Valyria, feared by pirates since the Doom, a mysterious cataclysm that abruptly destroyed the civilization. They recite together passages from an old tome.
Yeah.
The sight of Drogon flying ahead awes both men. Awed me too. That was so cool. Now we know where Drogon is.
Yeah, I mean, wow. First of all, Valyria, right?
Yeah, we got to see it.
This is the place that is briefly talked about in the books, but even in the books, we never see it. It's like the biggest mystery. It's mentioned in passing as the old home of House Targaryen. The smoking sea that they passed through was formed when the Valyrian Peninsula was shattered into a chain of large islands by the Doom, what they talk about. And the Doom sounds like it was this massive explosion of a chain of volcanoes that they came to refer to as the 14 Fires. So in the novels, this place is a lot more sinister. It has an ominous red glow in the skies above Valyria, where there's still some active volcanoes. Waters that are near boiling point and give off poisonous fumes. The ruins are feared to be haunted by demons and monsters, and few venture in there. They're afraid, you know, even Jorah says pirates are afraid to go there. So in the book version, Jorah didn't even attempt to sail through this smoking sea, and thus we never get to see it close up like this. But in the episode, they just brought this magical place to life. All of these visuals were stunning, and to me, it kind of looked like how you would picture the Hanging Gardens of Babylon look, with these big arches and this greenery, and it's sort of, the mist wasn't scary. It was almost beautiful when they were first riding in there on the boats. And Tyrion mentions how, even to this day, they can't build cities like that anywhere in the Seven Kingdoms. And, you know, I don't know what book they're speaking out of, but it kind of surprised me that we know Tyrion's a learned man. He's read a lot of books. He starts reciting about the Doom, and here Jorah comes and sort of breaks in, and he knows it too.
Yeah.
So it felt like a little bit of their first bonding moment to me.
I really enjoyed that scene. Again, we got to see a dragon, which was awesome, and then getting to see, you know, this beautiful, in a way, place.
Well, yeah, and seeing Drogon there, I mean, all I kept thinking was, wow, does he somehow instinctually know Valyria is the place where dragons used to roam and
he's
be born?
To.
It's like in him that this is his home, and so he's just been going and chilling there when he's not in Meereen?
I guess so. I mean,
that's incredible.
He's the head dragon, right? So Something's tied in there. Maybe he's like rebuilding it or having dragon babies in the volcanoes.
Well, yeah, I was kind of thinking, what's to say maybe there aren't still some dragons now waking
perhaps.
In Valyria in this fog that nobody knows about.
That would be cool.
Yeah, I mean, apparently old magic is awakening everywhere. So, but either way, you can't blame them that they're so distracted by this. The dragon flying overhead and the looks in their eyes that they don't see what's coming. Which is a shame, because here they are bonding. You're thinking, oh, this is how they can get together jointly. They'll find this common ground that their knowledge could really help Daenerys, and they could maybe work together towards this common goal. And then they're ominously going under this bridge, right? And they're both attacked by these stone men, which, goddamn, I mean, the makeup on these guys, right?
Oh, absolutely. Behind the scenes shows that it takes over 4 hours to apply the head and neck makeup to the actors.
Wow.
They state that it feels heavy like a wetsuit. And also they mentioned that the attack scene was shot in a pool.
That was a pretty badass scene when they're trying to fight them off the boat.
The whole time I was just thinking, oh, Tyrion was so much better off in that beautiful wagon with all
with
the
Varys.
Wine that he needed and another
idiot.
Smart man to talk to.
Yep.
Ugh.
Yep, and I mean, I kind of thought when Tyrion got, well, he knocked himself off the boat, really, because the guy was coming after him, but I thought they were going to end the scene there with him going underwater and you not knowing if he lives or dies, and I'm thinking people are going to be in such an uproar. But they didn't do that. They go to this last scene where they wake up on the beach that Jorah's dragged Tyrion to. I don't know where this is, somewhere off the shores of Valyria, I guess, where they think they're safe.
It's a big swim. Think about it. Like, they were under this overpass and it looked like a lot of rubble and it wasn't on like a beach that was away from everything.
Right.
So they must have swam for a while.
Yeah, well, he looks, you can kind of see Valyria off in the distance.
Yeah.
We're on the beach and it looks far.
Weird.
So now here's the question, right? I mean, we find out that Tyrion doesn't have grayscale, but the big thing is that at the end, when Jorah turns privately, he looks at his arm and he does. However, how do we know that one of those stone men didn't touch Tyrion, or that Jorah, in trying to save his life, carrying him all the way back in this swim, didn't touch him anywhere?
Well, our second time watching it, I was looking close to when he grabs him to cut the rope.
Yep.
And it looks like he touched the clothes. He didn't touch his hand.
Oh, yeah, but in that long swim, they
course,
didn't show
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
But then the question is raised, like, is Jorah immediately infective himself now? Or does that take a while, you know?
I wonder.
In the books, Jorah was never infected. It was a different person that Tyrion was with at this time who saved him from the Stone Men, a man called John Connington. So it looks like Jorah is going to be taking up some of that role.
Jorah the Explorer.
Either way, I was super happy to see Valyria. I thought this was an amazing decision on the showrunners, the writers, the producers, everybody's part to put this place together and have it feel like such an amazing gift to especially book readers who some of this stuff, it's just not new anymore. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden we're getting surprises. We don't always like them. To have a surprise that was so wonderful and fulfilling a place we've longed to see, I thought that was a great move.
It's definitely wonderful.
That's it for our locations for this episode.
We just have a few quotes that we thought were important enough to bring up.
Yep.
If I give everyone what they deserve, I'll have no one left to rule.
That
makes sense. That's true.
Yep.
With luck, you will find the strength to do what needs to be done. Maester Aemon.
Perfect for him.
This isn't a strange place. This is my home. It's the people who are strange. Sansa. Very ballsy of her.
I couldn't believe she said that.
And when she spoke that, it reminded me of last season when she was making, I think, out of sand her home. And she was like, I wonder if I'll ever get to see it again.
Out of snow.
Yeah. Oh, yep. Snow. That's right.
Yep.
So now she's home, but it's not what it used to be. And now she's around psychos and weirdos. It's almost like throwing it in her face. I feel like she'd be better off never seeing it again rather than having to live there as a slave now.
And I'm so glad you brought that up because I was thinking about that. Somebody else was speaking in the podcast on another GOT podcast about when Santa made that snow castle. Mm-hmm. And if you remember, Robin came in with his little doll and he was saying, "I'm a giant, I'm a giant, I'm gonna ruin your castle," and kind of like stomping on the castle walls.
Yeah.
And she got pissed off at him, and I don't know, it was like, you wouldn't think Martin would put something in for no reason. So was that symbolism of something that was going to happen to Winterfell in real life, in metaphor? I mean, it just kind of recalls all that now that she is, in fact, back in Winterfell.
Whoa. Something to think about.
Well, and my only quote that I have, which I thought was amazing, long sullen silences and the occasional punch in the face. The Mormont way.
Oh, yeah.
Tyrion to Jorah.
Yeah, you laughed when you heard that.
So I guess we'll finish with talking about our favorite character for the episode.
Weren't you going to mention to the listeners to remind them how right I've been in my predictions?
Oh, for sure. I mean, if you haven't been listening to when we started doing GOT podcasts, Jason's making a little bit of a joke here, but he actually has been so much more right on his predictions of what's to come with Game of Thrones than maybe any other fan only, a TV watcher fan only that I've seen. He's called quite a few things along the way that I've been sitting here saying, I don't want to spoil this, but then he'll just kind of come up with the right answer and I have to bite my tongue until it happens.
Wicked smart.
So yeah, we'll talk about our favorite character, and then if you would like to email us, write in about your favorite character for this episode, we will definitely talk about it on our next review. My favorite character this time was...
I'm sorry. I can't get over the fact that I just made you pat myself on the back.
Yeah, I mean, how about you pat your own self on the back over there? You want to tell us what you were right about this episode?
To be honest, this came up because when we were watching the show, she was saying how right I've been. And I was like, you should let the listeners know. So that's how it came up to be.
Hopefully if the listeners are listening, they do know, right?
I guess you're right. Yeah.
Can I talk about my favorite character?
Yes, go ahead.
All right. It's Maester Aemon. I just loved his quote where he talks about finding little joy in his command and about killing the boy because winter is upon them. I mean, that's going to be at the beginning of our episode, so I don't need to repeat it for you guys. But seeing his struggle, knowing he's 100 years old, he could have been ruler of these kingdoms. He was a Targaryen. Yeah. He gave all of that up to do what he believed so strongly in back in a time when the Night's Watch was an honorable station and men really went there because they had to defend the kingdom. In this place of loyalty, of strength, of courage. I mean, he even says he's freezing slowly at the top of the world where it's just miserable all the time. In the books, you hear about the things they have to eat and just every day the torture they have to go through. But on top of it all, he thinks part of his purpose is to help these younger people find their way now and to guide them. And, you know, Jon Snow, and he wishes he could be there for Daenerys. So I think he's wise, and I think he's exactly the kind of person they need at the wall right now.
I agree. My favorite was Jon Snow. I don't know if he's making the right decision. You know, this might turn around and just stab him in the back. Either he gets killed and loses the ships, or they play along with it until they're landed and settled and strong enough. Now they're inside the walls, and they go to... like you said, Winterfell, and with their giants, and stomp out Winterfell. Mm. But I hope it goes well. And the reason why he's my favorite character is because he's, again, having to make a really difficult decision where there is no winning.
Yeah.
And again, now he has to venture off north of the wall again. Not know what's going to happen.
It's a rough road.
He could so easily just get comfortable, and he doesn't allow himself to. He's just, he's awesome.
Jason, what do you think is going to happen if he does go north at this critical time, right? Is he going to leave somebody, obviously he's going to kind of run the wall when he's gone? Who do you think he's going to put in charge? How do you think things are going to shake down?
Well, I guess he has to put one, you were speaking earlier about those three men that are basically like under him.
Yeah, Alistair Thorne is obviously the first choice, right?
Yeah, I guess he's going to, which is, we don't really like him.
That's
but
tricky.
What else can you do, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's like, we didn't want this guy to be ultimately in power. We wanted him to be like a second under John, and then here we would go giving him the wall. But who else really is there? Can't give it to Sam. Mm. I mean, you'd love to give it to Maester Aemon, but he's 100 years old.
He's freezing.
Yeah, and what's going to happen by the time he gets back? Will there already be an attack? Can they deal with that? I mean, this is really, like you said, there is no right decision here. I don't know that I would have necessarily gone myself if I was John. Tormund says they wouldn't follow anybody else, but don't you think they kind of maybe would follow Tormund if he told them to come?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, I don't know. Like, is Tormund up to something? It doesn't feel like it because he seems like kind of a good guy, but who knows? Who knows? I'm really worried for Jon, and we're approaching rapidly the end of where we leave off with his story in book five. We're actually almost there. So I'm really on the edge of my seat that I don't much know what's going to happen for him in the future either.
Well,
my favorite character.
For the best. And I really hope they don't drain this out. Don't drain this out. I need to see something happen with Jon Snow.
Well, I think we got a lot of the wall and the north this episode. So I think next episode 6 will be the places we didn't see, like Dorne. Like Arya at the House of Black and White, Jaime and Bronn, any of the locations people didn't see will be next episode, and then maybe episode 7 we'll get back to some action at the wall.
And I want to know what the hell is going on with the bald guy.
Varys.
Like, how is he dealing with this? I need to know.
Yeah. There's a lot of loose ends here, but they still got time to tie things back up. And let's hear what you think. What are your predictions for the rest of the season? Who's your favorite character for this episode? Clearly, there were no wolves.
We'd like to thank you guys for listening and your continued listening. We ask again just to let your friends know about the CKC podcast. We need more listeners. We need a bigger army. Let them know about the podcast. Most people still don't know what a podcast is. If they don't know, explain to them. Show them how easy it is. And don't forget to go to our website, click on our Amazon banner. Do your shopping. Doesn't cost you any more, but gives us a little bit. Every little bit counts. So this round's on me. We love you guys.
We'll see you next week for our episode 6 review.
Please hang up and try again.